For the week of November 15th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 29, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, if you give us an hour this week, you really will walk away knowing more about the entertainment industry than you ever wanted to know. We have a ton of news stories to talk about this week. Michael, you were fantastic in highlighting stories this week that we should talk about in the show notes. Usually Michael just emails them to Karen and I, and then we have to put them in the show notes. But this week, Michael went to town. He has more entertainment news than, I think, Variety.
I know. Every time I got on it this week to look and see what was on it, I could always see that you were on it, Michael.
Well, we're going to have Harry Medved from Fandango joining us in a bit to talk about Twilight New Moon. But first, why don't we go over this week's box office, and Michael, take it away.
So it was a big week at the box office, a lot of news. The number one film of the week is, of course, 2012, which grossed $65 million in the U.S., a very strong amount, and a worldwide total, including the U.S., of $225 million. I bet in 10 years we'll be seeing movies that are, we'll be talking about worldwide grosses all the time for big summer and holiday blockbuster movies.
The fact that this movie made so much money is just appalling to me. This movie is not that great. And what I loved was Bob Mondello's review of it on NPR. First of all, he called it disaster porn, which I thought was funny. But I think he began his review by saying, "It's safe to say that Roland Emmerich's latest film is a disaster."
Well, he's never made a good movie, so I don't think anyone expected one. I saw it. It was the turn off your brain entertainment I wanted this weekend. I thought the special effects were really good, except for one scene, and it was stupid, but I knew that going in.
It was like watching a video game.
Well, and that's why so many people saw it, because they wanted a turn-off-your-brain kind of movie for the weekend, just like you did. Cool special effects. Yeah. We haven't had a huge movie like this in a little while.
It was 2 hours and 38 minutes long. That's how long it took to destroy the world. But it had a huge opening, and a very strong hold was the number two film, A Christmas Carol, starring Jim Carrey. That had a really good hold. It made $22 million. It only dropped 25%. It's in for a long haul. It's got the market wide open until December 18th when Avatar comes, and it should do well right through Christmas. Number three was The Men Who Stare at Goats, the George Clooney film. It made $6.2 million. It dropped pretty hard, over 50%, but it's made $23 million total, and it only cost Overture $5 million to pick it up. Number four was more great news for Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire. Lionsgate brought that movie up to 174 screens, and it made $6 million for a $35,000 per screen average. It's made already $9 million, which is a ton of money for a movie like this. So it's just steamrolling.
I actually listened to a couple of people talk about that film after having seen it. And I heard somebody on their phone telling their friends that they had to go see this movie. And I thought, huh, very interesting. This is how word of mouth about this film is going to turn it into a $100 million movie.
Yeah, well, you know, when Oprah's pounding the drum for it week after week, it's going to happen. Have you seen it yet, Karen?
No, I haven't.
I saw a movie this weekend. I saw the number five movie at the box office, Michael Jackson's This Is It, which, by the way, it was only supposed to play for 2 weeks, but this is its third week, and it made $5.1 million, dropping 61%, but it also, of course, fell off of 444 screens.
Yeah, well, it's you know, Sony, out of the kindness of their heart, they said they would only show it 2 weeks, but they graciously extended it another 2 weeks. It made $5 million, like you said, a total of $68 million in the U.S., and it's just over $200 million worldwide. So it is in the black. Sony is just starting to make money on this film based on how much they paid for it and how much it cost to open.
And it really was good. It was really a lot of fun.
I know, right?
But I have to say that, Karen, you on a previous episode mentioned that you wanted more Orianthe, which is the guitarist, the female guitarist. And she really is charismatic, but I was surprised at how kind of like ho-hum she was in rehearsals. Granted, she didn't know that anybody would ever see that footage. No,
Sperling, that's what makes her cool.
Oh, okay. So it's rock and roll?
Yeah.
Kind of ambivalence? Okay.
Yeah, that's what makes her so cool.
You would recommend the movie to people, Sperling?
Absolutely. And I understand what you're saying, Michael, or what you said on a previous episode about how some of the songs were kind of, he was singing over a track. And
well,
you know what?
Them, yeah.
They actually talk about that. He actually says at one point at the end of Billie Jean, he goes, well, okay, you know, that'll give us kind of the idea of how we're going to stage this.
Wow, you find it entertaining. Well, there you go.
Well, I mean, think about it. When is the next time you're ever going to see a musician of that kind of caliber and that kind of talent where he can sing and dance at the age of 50 and he still had it? When are you going to find that
Justin Timberlake?
Again? You know, I actually, it's funny you should mention that. I thought, well, maybe Justin Timberlake will be this kind of guy, but I don't know. I haven't really appreciated any of his music, and none of his music has become the worldwide phenomenon that Michael Jackson's Beat It and Billie Jean and Bad and all of those songs, Thriller. None of Timberlake's songs have become hits like those.
Well, I would disagree. I mean, with NSYNC and Solo, he's been one of the biggest acts of the world for the past decade.
Yeah, but I don't think I would call him a phenomenon like Michael Jackson, who crossed over into so many different demographics.
That's exactly what Justin Timberlake does. I'm not comparing him to Michael Jackson yet. He hasn't created the biggest album of all time, but...
Yeah, but when he has one of the best-selling albums of all time, then we'll talk.
Well, yeah. I mean, saying that you can't compare anybody to Michael Jackson because they haven't had the best-selling album of all time, well, all right, you'll never compare anyone. But certainly, he's in that mode. He certainly is a huge Michael Jackson fan, and certainly he's a huge, huge star. I mean, he's had huge worldwide hits. I'd say Justin Timberlake probably is approaching more good albums as an adult than Michael Jackson has had.
Probably.
You know, once you Thriller and Bad, I mean, you know, he doesn't have a lot of good albums, Michael. Well, and then the other top 10, you've got The Fourth Kind, which is dropping fast. It made $4.7 million. Couples Retreat crossed $100 million. Paranormal Activity crossed $100 million. They both made slightly over $4 million. They're approaching the end of their run. Law Abiding Citizen, I have to say, this is a movie made fun of. It's with Gerard Butler and...
Jamie Foxx.
Jamie Foxx. I want to keep saying Will Smith, and I know it's Jamie Foxx. I've interviewed Jamie Foxx. And it made $3.9 million. It's at $67 million. For this sort of anonymous film, you got to give your credit totally to the stars, I think.
I agree.
Yeah, if it wasn't for Jamie Foxx and Gerard Butler, this movie would not be at $67 million. The Box is disappearing fast. It's a retread of a Twilight Zone episode. It's made $13 million total. And Pirate Radio didn't open. It opened at number 11, made $2.8 million. It's a total dog. And not a very good movie. And that is just a flop opener for that film.
Well, you know, we should probably get Harry Medved from Fandango on to talk about next week's number one movie. What do you think?
Absolutely.
Okay, hold on a sec. Joining us now by phone is Harry Medved from Fandango, who is in the newsroom over there in Santa Monica. Welcome, Harry.
Thank you very much.
Now, I got an email from you earlier today that said that New Moon or Twilight New Moon or whatever this new Twilight movie is called, that with four more days before its November 20th release date, New Moon has already leaped over previous record holders to become the top-selling pre-release title in Fandango's 10-year history. And for those of you that don't know what Fandango is, who might be out of the country, Fandango is an online movie ticket sales website.
That's correct, and the official title is The Twilight Saga New Moon. And the reason why it's doing so well and why it's already the top advanced ticket seller on Fandango is because the fan base has expanded exponentially. I mean, it's been only a year since the last Twilight movie, right? And what has happened is we found on Fandango, for instance, 53% of people that we polled on the ticket buying site said that they were actually turned on to the franchise because of the first film. So it's not just book readers who are running out to see the film. These are people who are fans of the movie, Twilight, and then went back and read all the books. So it's a much bigger fan base.
There are so many fans now that when I was in Westwood over the weekend, I couldn't believe the number of people lined up, not to see the film, oh no, not to see the film. They are there to see the premiere, and not the actual film at the premiere. They're just there to watch the stars walk in. And this isn't just 100
right.
people. This is thousands of people wrapping around the block. And these are
huge
blocks.
Yeah, it's not just teenage girls either, right? I mean, you're talking about a lot of Twilight moms out there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
On our survey, we found that 22% of the people who are planning to attend the screenings this weekend are moms and daughters going together to the show.
That's right, because when anything scarier than a vampire or a werewolf is a cougar. Apparently, but
now
when you say the movie is or sexy personally, but when you say the movie is the record holder, do you mean actual number of tickets sold or the total gross of that, or what are you saying
no.
specifically?
Now, here's the crazy thing. We're talking about actual number of tickets sold. If you look at all the films pre-release, before their actual release date, how many tickets has Fandango sold in its 10-year history? You know, number 5 is Twilight, the first Twilight movie. Number 4 is The Dark Knight. Number 3 is Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince from earlier this year in the summertime. Number 2, and we never thought anything would beat this record, was Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, because remember back in 2005, that was like the most anticipated film of the generation. And now number 1 is New Moon. And as far as actual volume of tickets sold for any one movie before its release date. And for it to, you know, like the Star Wars record was achieved maybe the day of its release. The fact that we've already achieved this landmark 4 days before the release is pretty remarkable.
And to put it in perspective, it's not like, you know, Star Wars sold 8 tickets and now Twilight has sold 10. Fandango represents some of the largest movie theater chains in North America.
7 out of the top 10, movie theater chains, and including Regal Entertainment and Cinemark, Century, and AMC, Lowe's, etc. And, you know, what is interesting, of course, is we might be somewhat overrepresented with the Twilight crowd because they know to go to Fandango for these tickets. We sold 15% of all the tickets for the opening weekend for the domestic box office of Twilight.
Oh, wow.
It'll be interesting to see if that percentage goes up. First one around, I mean, as far as our surveys showed, it was like over 90% of the ticket buyers were women. This time around, there's a lot more action in the film. 98% of the people surveyed on Fandango said that the action in New Moon looks better than the action in Twilight. So I do think you're going to find more guys willing to go see the film or willing to get dragged along by their girlfriends to see the movie. Because you got more werewolf and vampire action. The first one didn't have that much action.
To your point, you know, I saw the first film on video, and I have to say the video was given to me, so I saw it for free. And now I'm actually interested in seeing the second film. I agree with you that the first film definitely got a lot more people interested.
I'm also interested in the second film to see what they're going to do with all. I mean, you know, for most of the movie, Edward's out of the story.
Right.
If you read the book, he's just kind of shows up in the beginning and then comes back at the end. And then, of course, what they do in the movie is they have visions of him throughout the entire film, so they get their Robert Pattinson fix throughout the whole movie.
Do you track who the favorite star is? Because obviously Taylor Lautner was almost cut from the film, and now he's appearing on all the talk shows. He's the big fixture in the trailers. I think he might be the big draw in a way almost for this new film.
Yeah, what is interesting is, look, if you ask, are you on Team Edward, played by Robert Pattinson, or Team Jacob, played by Lautner, you know, it's like 80% are on Team Edward for some reason or another. But when we asked the women who were buying tickets, which actor are you most excited about seeing taking his shirt off in New Moon? 61% went with Taylor Lautner because he bulked up about 30 pounds of muscle to play the part of Jacob in New Moon.
Why did you only ask the mothers and the women?
Sorry, Michael.
Touche.
I guess we should have.
I'm still trying to get over these fans that are sitting in Westwood for days. I mean, they were there as early as Thursday morning just to catch a glimpse of some of these actors walking into the Village Theater for the premiere. These lines wrap around the entire town. It's unreal.
We have to understand the appeal of Twilight, I think, to a lot of these, at least to the younger girls, which is that Bella, the central character of Twilight, is this young girl who is somewhat plain looking. And she's the clutchiest girl in the entire Pacific Northwest. She is constantly falling over herself, getting herself into end of trouble. But she has two gorgeous guys who are constantly rescuing her and telling her, "Don't worry, it's not your fault. You know, it's my fault." And like the only thing that Edward really wants to do is he doesn't really want to sleep with her. He does because she smells great apparently. But he's just trying to get into her thoughts, not into her pants, but into her thoughts. It's really frustrating to him that he can't read her mind. How many guys, you know, like that are not interested in sleeping with a girl but just want to read their minds? I mean, I don't know. It's a complete fantasy. And, Aaron, do you know any guys like that?
No. Who are only interested in reading my mind? Well, I mean, yeah, they might enjoy that, but...
Well, now, Harry, how is Avatar doing? There were two stories in the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. Michael Siepley wrote a story called "For Avatar, Budget Pops from the Screen," and then our friend John Horn teamed up with Claudia Eller. He wrote a story in Sunday's Los Angeles Times titled "Hoping Avatar is the New Face of Filmmaking." Both of these stories talk about how the budget may have reached about $500 million. Is that film tracking well on Fandango?
You know, it's hard to tell. We did a survey asking what's the most anticipated film of the season. Of course, New Moon trounced Avatar, but Avatar came in as number two. And the problem I think that Avatar is going to face is, will people see it for the love story? In Titanic, James Cameron's last huge multi-million-dollar gamble, you know, at least you have Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. But what are you going to do with Zoe Saldana and Sam Worthington in Avatar? I mean, they're two 10-foot-high blue creatures from another planet. I mean, it's kind of an awkward love story. They don't look like anybody I know, unless I guess you live on Venice Beach where I live. But apart from that, it's just, you know, it's kind of an awkward love story. So I think that the question is, how much will the sci-fi audience, you know, bring in? Obviously, it didn't hurt Terminator 2 that there wasn't much of a love story there. So, Cameron has a way of just constantly pulling it off. I mean, you remember when Titanic came out, everybody was talking about the budget. Everyone was freaking out. I'm looking at the story in Entertainment Weekly from 1999, where they're talking about how Cameron's in a bit of a jam. This is going to be the biggest disaster of all time. You know, oh my God, it's a shock-inducing price tag of nearly $200 million back then.
That's right. Horn and Eller in the Los Angeles Times pointed out that Terminator 2 was the first movie to cost $100 million. Titanic is the first movie to break the $200 million barrier, as you just mentioned. And now they're saying with Avatar, Jim Cameron appears to be the first director to crack the $300 million budgetary mark, which is quite astonishing when you think about the fact that they're also going to have to put $150 million into marketing the film.
Yeah, but you know, the one thing is that you gotta appreciate the fact that the guy's got major cojones, and that he doesn't really care that anybody is so worked up about the budget. A lot of it is his own money, right? As Heller and Horn pointed out, and I think Sifley pointed that out too. And kudos to him for trying something fresh and original. You know, I love the fact that you guys were at Comic-Con, you heard what he said there, where he was saying, you know, it's about time that we have a movie that's not based on a franchise like Twilight or Harry Potter. And it's, you know, it's not based on a book. It's not a sequel. It's just something that you've never seen before. And I am hoping that it will achieve what it set out to achieve and that people will go out and support it.
I think the entire motion picture industry is hoping that, because they've got a lot riding on this, especially the motion picture theater owners.
Yeah. Otherwise, everyone's going to say, well, we're not going to try anything original again at this budget. Forget it. They'll hold up Avatar as, you know, the poster boy for films that don't achieve anything dollars-wise, that don't have any kind of franchise behind it. They'll say, you know, the most you're going to make is like District 9 kind of money.
Well, Harry, thank you very much for taking the time to go over your sales, well, not necessarily sales figures, but the news that Fandango is selling more tickets than ever for Twilight Saga New Moon. Did I get it right this time?
Right.
Okay.
You did. You're going to be first in line on Thursday night, right?
I've already got my tickets.
He's got his Bella t-shirt.
Bought them through Fandango.
Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks Bye. A lot. Well, that was nice of Harry Medved to stop by, talking to us about the massive early ticket sales for the Twilight Saga New Moon. Speaking of Brave New Worlds, you know, we've got a couple movies opening up, like The Fantastic Mr. Fox, and we have Where the Wild Things Are. They're in theaters right now, and Coraline is out on DVD, and those all take people to Brave New Worlds in the theater. But they're kind of scary, and they're sort of family films, but they're sort of not family films, and people sort of have to figure out whether they should take their kids to it. And, of course, it depends on how old your kid is, what kind of movie it is, you know, what kind of movies they like. A.O. Scott had a story in the New York Times about this, talking about The Fantastic Mr. Fox and whether people should take their children to it. But, you know, some kids are ready for these movies. There was a story, I think Karen highlighted this on Gawker that linked to it, about a 9-year-old who was on the red carpet line and asking questions at the Fantastic Mr. Fox premiere. And this kid asked Meryl Streep a question about the difference between performing a character and doing the voice for the character. And she said it was the most sophisticated question she'd had on the entire time online. And as Karen said, the comments were hilarious.
No, I'm giving Sperling credit for that one, because I took a look at this story and I'm like, I don't understand. Who cares? Someone explain to me why this is an amusing story.
I just thought that, first of all, a 9-year-old asked the most profound question on the press line at the premiere, according to Meryl Streep. But then some of the comments to this Gawker story are hilarious. Dave J. writes, Grace went on to ask Miss Streep if she knows why Sasha Jones and Sylvie Errolson keep saying they aren't her friend at lunch and make the boys say that she smells funny. The Sometimes Why wrote, It should be mentioned that Miss McManus's follow-up question was to ask Miss Streep who her favorite Jonas Brother was.
I like the one where someone said that the kids should get a taste of real journalism by being fired. You know, they were fired shortly after they filed their story.
Yeah, well, and this one person wrote, "This is why McManus will keep her job. Maybe pro journalists should take a tip. Get your excellent questions published by someone else online. Keep the answers in your own print." And then the real JR, or the real Junior, wrote, "Yes, whatever, Meryl. But who are you wearing?" Yeah.
Okay, it's funny. I get it. I still think I should have been under Big Deal, Big Whoop. But okay, it's funny. It's adorable. I don't know. Maybe you need to have kids in order to really think it's funny.
I did think that this piece by Jeffrey Wells on his blog, Hollywood Elsewhere, he wrote a little bit on Wes Anderson's Fantastic Mr. Fox, and he says that he gives his foxes bent hind legs like all canines have. Even cartoon versions, Anderson's foxes walk around with straight legs and essentially stand. So he's complaining that the foxes didn't have bent hind legs. And he goes on to write about how this whole idea of the foxes not having bent legs actually disturbed him and took away from the movie. And the comments on this post are hilarious. Todd Gilchrist gets in the first one. Of course, Todd Gilchrist is an entertainment journalist who's been on Showbiz Sandbox with us on a previous episode. He writes to Jeffrey Wells, "So a fox wears a suit and drives a motorcycle, and those things you're okay with, but the bend of their hind legs you have a problem with? Priceless." And this person named Monique V wrote, "Jeff, have you discontinued your medication? Please reread this entry again and consider increasing your number of sessions per week."
Now, why did I find this one funny, but the Meryl Streep one not?
Just because you don't have children, but you do have hind legs.
But you don't have kids either, and you found the Meryl Streep one funny.
So we've had a lot of fun with animated films, and the list of animated films that are going to be submitted for Oscar consideration this year is growing.
Did you see how many films?
There's about 20 movies right now. Well, it's no surprise because there's another animated film every other week. There's about 20 films, and you know, in past years, you've almost always known what would be nominated and almost certainly what would win, usually the Pixar film. This year, I don't know. It's wide open. There's so many movies, and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, Coraline, A Christmas Carol, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Ice Age, Nine, Ponyo, the Miyazaki film, which is delightful. Disney's got The Princess and the Frog coming up. This funny little French film we saw called A Town Called Panic. And, of course, Up.
Actually, that film is Belgian. A Town Called Panic.
Belgian. I beg your pardon. Belgique. Excusez-moi. And so there's a, and that I've skipped over half the films like Monsters vs. Alien, Planet 51. I mean, I have no idea what's going to get nominated. I'm not even sure if Up will beat Ponyo or, you know, who knows, maybe The Princess and the Frog. It's a return to Disney's 2D animation. So it's wide open there, I think. It'll be really interesting to see what happens.
Well, first of all, Up is going to be nominated. End of story.
Yes.
Second of all, I think you can probably say Alvin and the Chipmunks is not.
Yes, correct.
Even though I like saying squeakquel.
It's squeakquel.
I'd love to hear them say that on stage.
But if they have three slots, if they don't expand to five.
I think they are expanding it to five, aren't they?
Are they?
I don't know. I'm
not sure. They should.
Well, I know that Mary and Max might get nominated. That is a very interesting animated film that was shown at Sundance. Coraline will definitely get nominated. And then it's up between Fantastic Mr. Fox and A Christmas Carol and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. You know,
Ice Age was a huge hit.
It was a huge hit, but I still think
Ponyo is Miyazaki. Yeah, Ponyo is Miyazaki. He's a beloved, you know, legend.
Yeah, Ponyo I haven't seen yet, and I really would like to see that. And you're right, I do think that has a good shot at being nominated.
Yeah. Well, I know that animated films, people will be arguing about them, and certainly exhibitors are arguing about when they go from theaters to DVD, because Sony has this new plan where they're going to offer Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which is a fun film. They're going to offer it to people online via internet TVs, TV that are internet compatible, and these newer version of the PS3 1 month before it comes out on DVD. So you can, if you have the right PlayStation 3 or the right TV, which is a minuscule part of the population, you'll be able to buy a download version of Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs an entire month before it comes out on DVD, which means they're shrinking that window even more, competing with DVDs by trying to sell it directly to people via their own technology. It's a big story. The New York Times had a story about it. Hollywood Reporter had a story about it. And people are, you know, angry and upset, the exhibitors, because they really want that window to stay steady.
Right, because basically what this means is that, well, if you just go out and buy a Sony television or a PlayStation 3, then you don't have to go see Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs in theaters. All you have to do is wait a month and you can download it and watch it at home. And this is just a follow-up to the story that we did last week on the MPAA and the FCC and the waiver that the MPAA is looking for to stream movies into the home. What I really find interesting about this is it's really just a play for Sony to sell more electronics, both televisions and PlayStation 3s. Because when you look at it, it's not as if they're going to allow Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs to be sold to anybody without a Sony television or without a Sony PlayStation 3. You can't buy it on the Xbox. It's those devices specifically, and specifically Blu-ray players. Of course, Sony is the big engine behind Blu-ray. They're the ones that fought for it. And I believe they own the technology, so they benefit the most if more people go out and buy Blu-ray players. It's really more of a push for electronics than it is for this film. Now, mind you, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs is a Sony film. So you see how it all ties together?
Synergy.
But yes. So, I mean, they're not trying to decrease the window as such. They're just trying to make their TVs and PS3s more exciting to people.
I think so. This is me talking. This isn't any, you know, any other story that was printed or published. This is me prognosticating, I guess.
Because I couldn't understand why they would make it available a month before they put it out on DVD. I mean, it's not like people are going to say, oh, wow, I wasn't going to buy it, but now it's available a month early and I can download it onto my PS3. By gum, I'm going to buy that movie. So it didn't make any sense to me sales-wise. You're not going to market it, so it's going to be hard to let people know. So I didn't understand why they were doing it and ticking off exhibitors, but it makes sense, like you say, if it's really just to add a little extra gimmick to their PS3 and internet TVs.
And the Blu-ray players during a time when most of these devices will be sold, the holiday season.
Yeah, but no one's going to buy the TV because of the month early. I'm saying they could make it available this way, but just make it available at the same time when they do it on DVD.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And not tick off the exhibitors. Not one person can say, well, I wouldn't buy it, but since it's 3 weeks earlier, by gosh, I will. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. On the other hand, G.I. Joe was just released to DVD, and it came out 88 days after it opened, just about 3 months.
Also ticking off every movie theater owner in North America.
Yes, making them very angry. And, of course, it did very well. It sold 3.8 million copies, and they usually don't release that sort of figure, including 500,000 on Blu-ray, which really astonishes me. That sounds really high. And it opened at number one, and it's doing great. But, you know, wouldn't it have opened at number one probably if it had opened on DVD 4 weeks from now? It was a huge success at the box office, $175 million or something like that. You know, they ticked off exhibitors. Did they gain any money? Do you think the box office is bigger for it on DVD because it came out today?
No, I don't think so. Not at all. I think it's just something that people waited until the DVD was out to see.
Yeah.
And this is a movie that had a lot of fanboys.
Yeah.
So
I have to admit, though, it feels like it was out 100 years ago. You know, when exhibitors complain about, oh, you can't shrink this window. I mean, to me, G.I. Joe, that came out ages ago. It doesn't feel like they rushed it.
Well, you know, since we're talking about animated films and DVDs, I actually have a little gripe. Now, Michael, this actually pertains to something that you mentioned on a previous episode about how Disney was releasing Up, the Pixar film. They are releasing it both as a DVD and in a trio pack. I don't know what you'd call it, but it's basically got three discs in it, a Blu-ray, a DVD, and then a digital file for your iPhone or your iPod or whatever portable device you want to put it on.
Yeah.
Now, I went and tried to get this three-pack. It's like $32 at Target and at Borders and at any of the big chain stores.
On Amazon.com, it's $19.99.
Right. No, I understand that. So I bought the DVD. What I didn't realize is the DVD alone does not come with any of the bonus material. So they are effectively forcing you to buy this three-pack, even if you don't have a Blu-ray player, even if you could care less about this digital file version of the film. You're being forced to buy it if you want the DVD extras, the commentary, the features.
That's not true. They do have a 2D DVD deluxe edition with a digital copy that is $19.99. It's the same price as the Blu-ray version with three discs, but it's the same price, so you don't save money, but it is available. They have the three-disc, the four-disc combo pack. They have the two-disc deluxe edition, which includes a digital copy, and they have the single disc, which I don't even know why they bother putting out anymore. So on Amazon.com, you can pay $19.99 for the Blu-ray, which is the four-disc combo, $19.99 for the two-disc deluxe edition, or $14.99 for just the single disc without extras.
And do you know why they actually put it out, that single disc?
Rentals
and Target and Walmart and all of those stores where people, they just want the movie. That's it. And that's where I saw this, and my choices were the single disc DVD or the four-pack or the three-pack or whatever they want to call it.
Yeah. Well, that's I hate all the multiple. I'm all for like keeping it as cheap as possible and just having the four disc combo pack. You know, if it's going to be the same price, $19.99, can't expect much cheaper than that. You know, that's pretty cheap for a new thing. But
for $19.99, it's a no brainer. But I will say, I really think, and I'm going to call it now, Up will win Best Animated Film for the year.
Oh,
does that mean I have to see it?
I would expect so, too. Well, yeah, you should certainly see it. But I would expect it to win, too. But you never know. It has some serious competition for a change. But yeah, I would expect it could get nominated for Best Picture, one of the 10 movies.
That's
I would
true.
Imagine and hope it would. It's certainly one of the best reviewed films of the year.
And the hard part is if it does get nominated for Best Picture, then of course it won't win Best Animated Feature. So I guess I should have reserved my right to kind of take all of that back.
Well, since Karen hasn't watched a movie this week, let's move quickly to television. Karen, were you upset like everybody else to find out that Dollhouse, the Joss Whedon show, had been axed?
No. And I wasn't surprised either, although I do have to say that I Joss Whedon is like the kiss of death, I suppose.
I can't imagine
he would forgive Fox for this, right? Although they kind of gave him plenty of chances.
They gave him an extra season. I mean, at the end of last season, they were talking about canceling this show.
Yeah, and it's not a good show.
Well, then there you go.
I know, right? But, you know, he creates cult favorites. I mean, people I know who watched this show loved it.
And people loved Firefly, and they canceled that, too. People still reference that.
And Buffy. What about Hank? Did you watch the Kelsey Grammer show at all? That also got axed this week.
I had never watched Hank, and frankly, I think that they...
Nobody watched Hank.
Yeah, I think they may have canceled this a little too early. ABC canceled it, but they put it on, I don't even know when. Was it Wednesday night? I can't even tell you when it was on. But they kept preempting it for some special or another. You know, it was, you know, the CMA Awards, the sporting event. I don't know what they preempted it for, but they did it a number of times, and I think they may have not given it enough time.
But it didn't help that it got terrible reviews and it wasn't supposed to be a very good show.
Okay, like Dollhouse, I would agree with you.
Kelsey Grammer sort of over, isn't he?
And it was part of a block that was doing well. You know, they're very happy about Modern Family and Cougar Town, the Courtney Cox show. So it suffered in comparison to the shows that were around it as well.
And I think the idea for the show was right, that it was, you know, a corporate bigwig having to downsize. But there were so many comments that, like, he still lived in, like, a mansion that we were supposed to believe was, like, downsizing. And I think there's just too much of, you know, F you.
When Hank was canceled, all the headlines were the same, you know, Kelsey Grammer downsized at ABC.
Well, speaking of downsizing, Current TV, the startup channel created in part by Al Gore, suffered a major bloodbath as another 80 employees lost their jobs. We linked to a story on TechCrunch.com about this. They've confirmed that 80 people are being let go, leaving the company with 300 employees worldwide, which is probably 300 too many. Current Media COO Joanna Drake Earle, did she talk to you over the phone, Sprung, or is that talk to the reporter?
That's a cut and paste out of the article.
Oh, yeah. She said that the layoffs are due to a shifting of programming strategy and not a cost-cutting measure. Okay, tell it to the employees who are out of a job. They're shifting away from in-house production and towards outsourcing segments, which will be done via acquisitions, co-productions. And a year ago to date, the company, which was co-founded by Al Gore and Joel Hyatt, eliminated 60 positions. The media company also recently canceled its $100 million IPO. That was a good decision.
Yeah, I mean, anybody trying to do an IPO today of a network, I mean, there's no way that's going to fly.
Yeah, but this was a stupid idea when Al Gore announced it. Oh, people are going to create their own stuff. It's like, it's called YouTube, Al. It was a stupid idea. I've never heard of a single thing about it. I don't know a single person who's ever heard of it or watched it. And it will never fly. And the sooner they cut their losses and close shop, the better.
Actually, I really like Current TV.
Yeah, I'm going to take the other side to that. I think Al Gore was really onto something. And Current TV was announced before YouTube, you know, really entered the zeitgeist. I mean, YouTube was probably around, but Current TV was first.
Well, usually if you're first, you're in like Flynn, right? So they did something wrong.
Yeah, they screwed up. They screwed up. And a lot of their stuff was, you know, I think they wanted to focus on being kind of goody-goodies. It was like saving the environment and, you know, eventually they had some entertainment show. I mean, their shows were boring. That was the problem.
You guys should really take a look at it sometime. But if you watch Current TV, there's a lot of little tiny segments on it that are really interesting and giving documentary filmmakers, especially short documentary filmmakers, a chance to have their work seen. It's really fascinating. I think the problem is, yes, they launched and may have been first. That would be interesting to find out who was first, YouTube or Current. I believe they kind of came to the fore at the same time. But the difference between YouTube is you can go to YouTube, see something interesting, and then blast it out to 200 of your friends via email. Current TV is on cable or satellite, and it's one of hundreds of television channels. And if you turn to it and love it, you actually have to talk to those same 200 or 300 people, your friends, to tell them about Current TV individually rather than all
It's not at once. Easily shared.
Correct. Thank you.
And you have to find it. I mean, I have no idea where Current TV is on my TV. None.
I actually had to look for it.
Aren't there a million outlets for short documentary films like Sundance and IFC and Doc Channel and PBS?
Yeah. How much does Sundance pay again?
How much does Current TV pay again?
They actually do pay.
How much? They don't pay much.
I don't know, but I know a bunch of filmmakers that are actually, they're making not a hefty living, but they're able to pay the bills off of what they sell to Current.
Well, that won't last. YouTube was launched February 2005. Current TV launched on August 1st, 2005. So YouTube was first.
Again, I think it was a really good idea on his part. It just wasn't pushed through properly.
Well, what did they do wrong? If you guys both like it and think it's interesting and fun and you like to tell people about it, what have they done wrong?
I think it was boring, hard to find. it didn't have a cool factor because Al Gore has never been considered cool. Because remember, this was launched before An Inconvenient Truth, and you could argue he's still pretty uncool. YouTube was popular because people felt like they had discovered it and created it themselves, whereas Current TV was thrust in their face.
Yes. So, did you read this story about John Mayer's latest album?
Whose latest album?
Sorry, John Mayer.
Oh, Mayer's. Yes.
My neighbor, by the way, lives right around the corner from me.
Really?
Yeah. See him at the grocery store all the time. No, we do not hang out. John Mayer and I, we're not hanging out at all. he is a rock star. And then there, you know, the problem for me is that I'm not, actually. So, well, he has this new album coming out November 17th called, I can't remember the name, Battle Session or Battle Studies? Battle Studies.
Battle Studies.
And it's highly anticipated, according to some people whose stories we will link to in the show notes, and it leaked online. And rather than get all upset about it, he basically said, all right, you know, have fun, have at it. Just, you know, at some point, register your free copy by buying the album. And he did this via Twitter. So he reached out directly to his fans and said, look, I know it's out there, but pay for it. And just for fun, I wanted to see how easy it was.
Thief.
I knew I was going to get that from you.
I
knew walking down this road with Michael is a sticky wicket. I really was interested to know. I found out that it had leaked, and so I figured out how to download a BitTorrent, went to a BitTorrent site, not the Pirate Bay, but another one, and found a link to a torrent, downloaded the torrent, and then downloaded the entire album. The time it took me to do all of that, 5 minutes, 48 seconds.
Wow.
Now, mind you, the next John Mayer album I buy will be the first John Mayer album I will buy. So technically, I am not taking money out of John Mayer's pocket because I never would have bought that album to begin with. And you know what? The next time I see him, I'm going to give him $12.
I'm sure he'll appreciate that in a grocery store.
Well, that's very noble of you. How was the album?
And you know what? I have to say, it was pretty good. Some of the, you know, I only listened to about 6 or 7 songs, but the songs I listened to were really good. And frankly, now I'm actually more tempted to go out and buy some of his other albums. So you see, they gave me something for free, but now I'm going to go spend money on some of the other albums, kind of like the other 7 albums I downloaded.
Well, he didn't give it to you.
I think
for
his
free,
music's
right?
pretty good. I mean, he's got some, you know, really cheesy stuff, but he's a good musician.
Oh, speaking of which, so the same day I found this article called, it was on Pop and Hiss, or, well, Pop and Hiss is the LA Times music blog, and they were referencing, I guess, a chat he had with Christiana Ablahad. I'm sure I'm butchering her name.
A vulture from New York Magazine. That was a horrific interview.
Oh, it was hilarious. I couldn't believe it. So, Karen, do you know this Christiane Abelhald or whatever?
No, but I'm familiar with Vulture and New York Magazine.
Okay, well.
And, she writes for them.
Well, apparently John Mayer was at a party at the El Decor, sponsored by Armani Casa. And this journalist ran into John Mayer and started asking him questions. And she starts off by, "What do you think about Obama receiving the Nobel Peace Prize?" And he says, "I think it's fantastic. Why? What's your overall opinion?" And then John Mayer responds, "Do you think I'm smart enough to be able to articulate to you why our president receiving the Nobel Peace Prize is a bit early for things? What's your overall opinion?" And she says, "What do you think about healthcare? Would you take the public option?" And he says, John Mayer says, "Have you ever heard me play guitar? I'm really effing good. You know what I'm bad at? Answering questions about public healthcare. This is not my wheelhouse. Do you have any questions about music? I almost got a mad need to let
you know." That was fun.
Yeah, and he goes on about it. He says, "If someone gave me the Nobel Peace Prize and I didn't deserve it, I would just shut my mouth and enjoy the hell out of it."
Okay, you guys thought this was funny? I thought this was so incredibly insulting, and I thought it showed him to be a complete asshole.
Him?
Yes.
No, she's an idiot for asking. If he doesn't talk about public issues, she's an idiot, he's an idiot for asking him questions about it. Once he's like, "Yeah, that's really not my area of expertise. Why are you asking him about the public? If they want to hold forth on a public issue and that's their thing, or they're dealing with a political film, I think that's fine. But I thought his response was refreshing. Thank God he doesn't act like he's some sort of, you know, expert on public policy. He's like, "Look, I play guitar. Why are you asking me these questions? Ask me stuff about
music."
Maybe
it's because he blogs for the Huffington Post, and maybe it's because he tweets and acts like he knows everything about everything.
About he blogs on political issues? I mean, if he's written and talked about certain issues, then yeah, I would say that's perfectly reasonable to say, "Well, but you wrote about it." But I'm assuming he doesn't claim to be an expert on this stuff. And, you know, if George Clooney wants to talk about Kenya, well, all right, that's fine. Or, you know, he's put himself out there as being, you know, an expert on certain issues or to talk about.
Well, he's written a post right here that I'm looking at for the Huffington Post, and he's talking about Live Earth. Okay, granted, this is 2 years ago. But, you know, he makes points to Al Gore and talks about how Gore's got the collective ear of a generation and how important environmental issues are. And come on, he's putting himself out there. He's always positioning himself as some kind of an expert and that he's like such a smart guy. You've got one girl who asked some questions that, like, apparently she didn't even want to ask. It was her editor who made her ask. And he treats her like complete shit.
Hey, 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 this is a family. It's a family show.
And the writer.
It sounded like
LA
a funny
Times
response. Maybe it was obnoxious when it happened.
If he was talking to a male writer, would he have talked this way?
He probably wouldn't have gone up to the male writer.
I didn't know whether
place.
He was talking to a male or a female writer. All I heard was his quotes. And so, not knowing whether the reporter was a woman or a man, I thought his comments were perfectly funny and reasonable. Unless he's talking about the public option all the time in healthcare, and all I can find on Huffington Post is a generic thing that he's 3 posts, one on Live Earth, which he performed at, one where he said Barack Hope is not a buzzword, and one on Don Rickles. This guy is not a public policy guy. He's never pretended to be. I've never heard him holding forth ad nauseum on public issues. If he does, fine. But if he, you know, once you've asked him one question, he's like, yeah, that's really not my thing. To say, well, what about the public option? It's stupid.
So she was an amateur, but he completely, he just dressed her down and made her feel even worse. That's, is it sort of funny? Yeah, I get it. I understand where it's coming from, but it's just an example of the fact that guy's got absolutely no class whatsoever.
Well, that may be true, but I thought he was making fun of himself and saying, I play guitar. I don't know anything about this stuff. That to me is not making fun of the reporter. That's making fun of himself.
Well, what he says about Obama getting the Nobel Peace Prize, he says, what's he going to do? Send it back? It's like I'm getting a wrongful bulge in my pants and everyone's thinking I've got a 9-inch and we'll just leave that word out. But let's just say it begins with C and it's...
Yeah, come on. Are you kidding me?
Well,
I didn't read this article. I'm only hearing the stuff you say them to me as you say them.
He says
girlfriend problems.
He says, I'm not going to argue with them. I'm going to let everybody think I have a 9-inch... Well, fill in the blank.
Yeah, and then he calls her a moron a little bit later on. It's like, oh, God.
She asks him, what do you think about guys with 70s mustaches? And he says, I don't give an F about who wears their face that what way. If I could grow a beard, I'd have some nutty things going on my face. And then the journalist asks, you can't grow a beard? And Mayer says, it's a pituitary thing. I know you're not that much of a moron. And then she asks, these are questions my editor wanted me to ask. I'm trying to build my journalistic career here. And Mayer says, you're not building a journalistic career. You're making yourself look like a moron, and you're not a moron. Taken in context, this could have been pretty funny. I mean, he may have been...
What do you think about guys with 70s mustaches? That's a question that you think deserves, like... once she's already been like, what do you think about the public option? What do you think about guys with 70s mustaches? That's just stupid, moronic stuff.
But then even when she gets to his album, she's asking not necessarily interesting questions. And she eventually asks, you don't always have to rhyme, though. And he responds, I'm going to forcefully sodomize your editor. Which I know is rude. I know it's crass. But you could just see this happening. As a journalist who's been in that position before, you can see that happening. That whole exchange. You could see a drunk celebrity... who he probably was drunk.
And she didn't plan the interview. She didn't set up an interview. She just ran into him at a party at the El Decor-sponsored Armani Casa party, where he was playing host. He's known for political outspokenness. I wonder why. Karen, it sounds like, it sounds like he's a bit of a jerk. I've always liked him because of his comment when he won his first Grammy, where he said, I know this came really fast, and I hope to live up to it, which I thought was a very graceful thing about winning, you know, a Grammy out of the gate. I have no opinion about him in his private life, but I do get really bored and tired of stupid, moronic questions from people for stupid interviews where they just rattle off dumb stuff. It really tires me. It just seems very antagonistic and designed to get answers or antagonistic answers out of people. To me, that's sort of what it sounds like here a little bit, but it sounds like they were just trying to get antagonistic comments from him.
So Karen, you're saying that this whole story is kind of a big whoop. Which is my horrible segue into our popular segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss entertainment news stories from this past week and decide whether they are a big deal or whether anybody cares about them.
All right, I'm going to start.
Our new theme music.
I put on My Dad Says, whoa. The sitcom. I know, sorry, but that's what it's called. This popular Twitterer who tweets as... My dad says, and it's just.
Well, can you? You're killing me here.
Shoot! My dad says that's not what it's called.
It's going to be a sitcom, and they'll probably have that in the title.
I think they're going to have SH, and then with an asterisk, and then a T.
I don't know.
Then how are people going to talk about it?
About the increasing expletives. I heard, damn it. Pardon me for anybody who gets offended, but you know, people were complaining about South Park. Some of the religious right complained that they were bleeping out the word God and leaving in the word damn it. And so you might think they would put in God and start to blurt damn it. But instead, what they did was they've just started to say the word, the expletive, God damn it, on South Park. And you hear it every week now. Damn it, man. And it's really kind of unbelievable. But you can look and see curse words coming throughout prime time now. And I wouldn't be surprised if this show is actually called My Dad Says.
You guys are really trying to make it really hard for me to edit this episode, aren't you?
Well, just put a little comment at the beginning saying there's mild expletives in a section where we're discussing them.
I'm just going to call it the profanity-filled podcast.
But anyway, so this tweeter, whose name is Justin Halperin, and he's only been tweeting this whatever we want to call it, for since like August or something, maybe sometime in the middle of the summer. And he's already got himself a deal for a sitcom. And when I first heard this story, I was just completely dumbfounded. But then I read that he's the senior editor of Maxim.com, and now it all sort of makes sense.
Yeah.
Big, little, big whoop.
And he's got a book deal. So you say big whoop. I say big deal because
I think it's a big deal.
I was like, I thought I'd have to write a script. I thought I would have to do a treatment. I thought I'd have to do all this stuff to get a movie deal. And all I have to do is do a Twitter. Maybe I can get a deal if I just write a haiku, you know? So I think it's a big deal. It lowers the bar for getting a movie deal, and that's good in my book.
You want a movie deal for your haiku, darn it.
Yes.
Well, then once you get your movie deal, maybe they can turn it into a television show 30 years from now and then revive it 30 years after that, kind of like they're doing with Charlie's Angels, which apparently ABC is in the works to produce a pilot of.
Yeah, they tried to do this in 1988 called Angels 88, but it just like never... I'm not sure it was ever even cast, or maybe it was cast and just never went to pilot. I consider this personally to be a big deal because I would totally watch it. But in the grand scheme of things, it's a big whoop because it's really just another show. Michael?
It's a big whoop because it's been done a million times. You know, old shows redone. The right cast, the right gals, they'll be less, you know, less decorative and more, I'm sure, like smart, good angels. And, there's no reason why that brand can't get you a big audience. So it could work, but it's a big whoop. Let me know who's cast first, then I'll get excited. Give me a lesbian angel. That's what I want.
Oh, my God.
We'll get a black angel, a Latina angel, and a lesbian angel. It'll be the Charlie's Angels UN pilot.
Wow. Wow, she's still laughing. That's not... Apparently, that's more Karen's humor. The John Mayer humor did not float her boat, but the UN pilot Charlie's Angels humor, that one worked. Moving on to our next story, MGM is up for sale, according to several sources, including Variety. In a statement, MGM said it was beginning a process to explore various strategic alternatives, including operating as a standalone entity, forming strategic partnerships, and evaluating a potential sale of the company. So that's like saying, you know... We are beginning a process to explore whether we should do business. I mean, those are like the three choices. I mean, well, it's like sitting in bed saying, you know, I'm exploring the opportunity of either getting up or remaining in bed today. As opposed to what? Oh, brother. Of course, this is the studio behind the James Bond franchise and 60, 70, 80 years old. It's got 4,000 titles in its library, and everybody's buying it all the time for its library. So it's up for sale again. Frankly, I think that they just need to stop making movies like Fame. This is a big whoop until it happens. Quite honestly, it's probably a big whoop even after it happens because somebody will buy it, and then 5 years from now, they'll sell it again.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. It's a big whoop because it's been sold so many times.
It's a big whoop because it's been for sale for ever since I've been moved to New York and started covering the entertainment business. But they do have half ownership in the Hobbit movie, so hopefully that won't slow things up. But maybe Peter Jackson will buy MGM. That would be a big deal.
Our next story is actually a callback from last week about Gossip Girl and their threesome with apparently Hillary Duff. Ratings soared 20%. Big deal or big whoop?
It's sort of a big deal, I think, for its little... corner of the world. It was racy, and they didn't hide it. I mean, you didn't see nudity or anything, but you clearly knew what was happening. And for its own little corner of the world, I say big deal. In the grand scheme of life, big whoop.
I say big deal. You had Hillary Duff with a girl-on-girl kiss. It was very exciting. You saw all three of them wake up in bed the next day. It's just, as far as people who get upset about the envelope pushing of television, it's just one more example of how TV goes farther and farther every day. Thank you, parent, what was the name of the advocacy group? The Parent Television Council, which tried to raise a ruckus about it and just brought my attention to the episode.
Yep.
Well, we talked about Michael Jackson earlier on this episode, and apparently he's making news with Cirque du Soleil, who is pursuing his music for a show. Roger Friedman, our friend from Hollywood Reporters at Showbiz 411, wrote the story. He's following in the footsteps of shows built around both the Beatles and Elvis. The money involved is said to be astronomical, and frankly, I don't know what space has to do with this story. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, I say it's a big deal because it would be it's a good extension of the Michael Jackson franchise, and it would just be a huge, hugely popular thing. Cirque du Soleil shows run for years. It would just become a fixture wherever it lands in Vegas or wherever it gets placed around the world.
I'm sort of uncertain. Part of me wants to think Big Whoop because this is just going to be the first of probably many such things using his music. So we'll see.
Our next story is about the Hollywood Reporter, which says big stars are passé. Cheap franchises with no names like Twilight are the future. Frankly, I think that the Hollywood Reporter is becoming passé. From what I understand, from what I understand, they're not going to be publishing the paper edition for very long. I think January, March, that time frame, it seems like they're going to go online only. We'll see if that's true.
That makes sense to me that they would go to online only because the news is old by the time you print it up and ship it to someone's office. And the daily editions are like 8 pages, 12 pages. So what's the point? I imagine just doing the weekly is plenty.
Now, what about our Hollywood stars passé?
Incredibly moronic story. That's the oldest. That's Hollywood's wet dream, and it's not true, and it will never be true.
I'm going to not entirely agree with that. I do think there's a lot to be said that the industry kind of went overboard in putting stars in their movies because they just wanted to sort of cover their own butts. I think that somewhere along the way, we kind of lost the concept that there's nothing better than a good story well told. And although I think that this subject matter is passé, I like the fact that they're writing about it because I think people need to be reminded that, you know, there are good actors out there, there are good stories out there, and they don't necessarily have to be by really famous people or acted by really famous people.
Another story that we have pegged for this week is not necessarily about a movie star, but about a reality television star, Omarosa, from The Apprentice. She is going to have a new reality series and is teaming up with Donald Trump for it. The information comes from Mark Berman's The Programming Insider, which is both his podcast and a blog. And Donald Trump will be partnering with TV1 for a new reality series called Omarosa's Ultimate Merger, with the former apprentice contestant going in search of a husband. Ay, ay, ay.
And this is such a big whoop to me that's like not even worth talking about, Michael.
it's beyond a big whoop.
Now, Michael, you've highlighted something here about American Idol, Chris Allen single versus Adam Lambert 2012 single.
Yes, they both have singles out. It's an American Idol showdown. Chris Allen's single from his debut album is out, and Adam Lambert has the big end of the movie credits single over 2012, the movie that just grossed $225 million worldwide. So both videos are out. You can watch them both, and if you don't want to see 2012 in the theater, if you watch Adam's video, you see basically the entire plot of the film condensed to about 4 minutes, so you can save $10 and 158 minutes of your time. Karen, okay. Did you watch them, and how did you think they both
did? I didn't even know that Adam Lambert's was available. This is like a major squee moment for me. As soon as we're done recording, I'm going to go watch it.
So these are both big deals for you. But frankly, I think Chris Allen is going to win hands down because nobody's actually going to stay all the way to the end of 2012 to see the song that Adam Lambert has on the credits.
Well, no, that's a single. It's the first single from his debut album, so it's in the radio stations. It doesn't matter about staying in the movie. The video's out. The song is out. It's on his debut album. It's going to get lots of attention.
Well, ending today, we're going to end with some inside baseball, which we skipped last week. And we kind of mentioned the story on our way out last week about Mark Zorati over at Disney. He is out at Disney. He was the president of Walt Disney Motion Pictures Group. He was at the studio for 29 years and oversaw global marketing for the entire theatrical slate and was one of the most powerful studio executives in town. His tenure delivered numerous $1 billion plus domestic and overseas years, including an extraordinary run of 12 consecutive $1 billion years at the box office during his time as president of Buena Vista International. That's quite a feat. Now, of course, Dick Cook, who was the head of the studio, was kind of ousted by Bob Iger back in September, and Mark Zorati was one of Dick Cook's boys. So out he goes. It looks like Rich Ross, the new head of the studio, is bringing in his own team. So there's a lot of movement over there at Disney.
What? When you're Mark Cerruti mm-hmm. and you lose your gig, what do you do? Where does he go now?
You know, it's funny that you should say that. I was thinking the exact same thing. I thought, wow, he worked for one company for 30 years and was then tossed aside. What do you do when you've reached that level and then get tossed out? I mean, obviously, he's probably going to get a nice severance package, but then what?
What do you do with yourself?
Well, he probably will wind up with a producing deal, so that's one
thing. Well, assuming he wants it.
Yeah, assuming he wants it. But then a lot of executives like this wind up in companies where they are kind of executive producers and bring investors into projects, kind of like a summit. They'll wind up at a summit where they're the executive mm-hmm. overseer, and they team up with kind of a creative producer who then oversees the creative side of things.
I hear MGM is available.
On that note, we should probably wrap up. If you want links to any of the stories we discussed on today's show, you can find them on our website. Showbizsandbox.com is the website to look up, and the links will be in the show notes for episode 29. Our website is where you will also find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook. We are going to be trying to be a little bit more active on Facebook by starting some discussions and updating our status a little bit more, so feel free to look us up in the fan pages area. If you would like to email us, feel free to do so. You can email us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can send us comments on the stories we discussed or give us some feedback. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music you hear at the beginning and end of our shows is by the popular rock group MGMT. You can find them and look them up and hear all their music on MySpace. The address is myspace.com/MGMT. They also have a website that is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz you can find on michaelgiltz.com. He's also on Twitter. I believe the username is Michael Giltz. Is that correct, Michael?
Yep.
And Karen, you're also on Twitter. kwoody3939 is the username to look up. And her writing can be found on industrynexus.com. Also, Karen Woodward online. My Twitter username is @Sperling, and my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.